Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado. No wonder Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
1-2-585-5554 or visit Larson.law. That's Larson.law.
See 4abc.com for details. Is your AC falling behind? Warm rooms? High bills? It's time to replace. At ABC, our certified techs deliver expert installs with zero stress and zero surprises. Replace today and get zero payments and 0% APR for 18 months. Call today or visit 4abc.com. Trust ABC Plumbing, Sewer, Heating, Cooling, and Electric, and consider it done.
It's David Hochberg from Home Sweet Home Chicago. Laugh while learning about real estate this Saturday at 10 a.m. Mr. Jennings, who are my guests?
Janelle Iacino from Rose Pest Solutions. Pete Marrero, Blue Sky Restoration Contractors. Tegan Overhaug from Integrity Concrete Coatings. And Jeremy Hogle from MegaPros Home Repair, Remodel, and Renovation Experts.
Download podcasts of previous shows and submit all your questions at WGNDavid.com. Home Sweet Home Chicago with me, David Hochberg, this Saturday at 10.
Save big on everything for your roofing or siding project when you shop at Menards. Soffit adds the perfect finishing touch to your home's exterior and keeps your attic cool and dry. White, brown, and black aluminum soffit is in stock and ready to take home today. Shop all our building materials products in-store or on Menards.com. And check out all of our great deals going on now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Monday, controversy over Illinois' proposed school cell phone ban. How one local high school does it.
Someone passed an old-fashioned note.
Monday on WGN TV News at 9.
You have a business, and your business requires a dependable IT system. But you need support and service that you can feel confident in. You need Just Right IT. Your IT systems demand 24-hour monitoring to ensure your data integrity is secure and functional, along with a help desk that can troubleshoot technical issues as they occur. Just Right IT also provides communication and internet services. If your current phone system is more than 5 years old, it's time to experience the technological advancements that your current system is lacking. At Just Right IT, their focus is on every aspect of your company's IT infrastructure, so you can focus on what's most important, running your business. For a free IT audit report that gives you complete visibility into your IT infrastructure, just go to justrightit.com. That's JustRightIT.com. Just Right IT, technology with integrity.
Hip, hip, hooray for DNA. It provides the key to the plans for making everything in you and me.
Welcome back. We're talking about foster parenting and adopting in light of Mother's Day and the idea that it's National Foster Parenting Week. But I want to talk a little bit about something, that, genetic genealogy, that has been used for 25 years to help adoptees find their mothers and fathers. And as you probably know, the same technology is being used to identify victims and of crimes and perpetrators. We have in studio an amazing person who is going to talk to us about identifying perpetrators of violent crimes and to help people get closure in identifying bodies and who these lost people are. And she's also helps Holocaust survivors and their descendants connect with lost family. Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick is an internationally recognized forensic genealogist and pioneer, really the inventor of the forensic genetic genealogy. She's the founder and director of Identifinders International and led the team that solved the first two cold cases using genetic genealogy even before the well-known case of the Golden State Killer. Welcome to the show, Dr. Fitzpatrick.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for having me.
It's good to see you in person.
Yeah.
So let's talk about genetic genealogy. Let's just give it the 101 of what it is and how it works?
Well, basically, it's based on adoption searches that genetic genealogists have been doing since about 2000. And if you know, you can take an ancestry DNA test, for example, and you come up with what we call DNA cousins. And all these people are related to you, so they have to be related to each other, either through marriage or through blood. And so what you can actually do is when you start building their family trees and they start to connect. And all of those people are related to each other, so they have to be self-consistent. If you get 10 people that are close enough, it's sort of like a big Sudoku puzzle, because all the people have to be consistent with their relationships with each other. And then when you're done and you have the puzzle filled in, there's going to be a tile missing, and that's the person you're looking for, one of the siblings, because he's got to be consistent with everything else. So you can look at it as a big Sudoku puzzle, because everybody has to be related.
Now, through your company, Identifinders, you help identify perpetrators of crime, but also unidentified bodies. Can you give our listeners a short and sweet explanation of how you do this? And one of the things that I've heard you talk about is that it's not just the DNA, that's a piece of it, but there's more to this kind of identification than just the science.
Well, yes, there is. Now, DNA and genealogy work hand in hand. You have to have both. We've had cases where the DNA went very quickly, but the genealogy took a couple of years at least. We've had cases where the DNA went on for 3 years, and then at the end, it took us 5 minutes to solve. I mean, it happens. So they work hand in hand. And as I said about the adoption searches, we basically do the same thing, because when you start out, it doesn't matter if the DNA belongs to an adoptee, an unidentified human remains case, or a violent offender. It's DNA, and you don't know who it belongs to, but you'd like to find out. So we don't use Ancestry, 23andMe. We have our own databases, our own labs that basically do the same thing, but are within the scope of using them by law enforcement, within the policies and procedures of law enforcement. So we do the same thing. We have our data, DNA process, we have data, we upload it to the right databases, similar to Ancestry, similar, but not Ancestry itself. And then we have a list of DNA cousins. We have family members of the unknown person, whether it's a John or Jane Doe, or it's a violent offender. You don't know who it is, but you have their family members, and sometimes the family members are really close. In one case that went in 5 minutes, when we uploaded, we found that actually, that DNA match was the gal's sister. So once we, you know, saw that she shared about half of her DNA with the unknown woman, we knew immediately, because of that amount of DNA, it had to be a sibling. So we looked up who that girl was in the database, and we looked up her family, and she only had that one sister, if I remember, and she had gone missing. And that sister had actually been on podcasts trying to find...
Oh, my gosh. Amazing. So, you know, I'm sure there are people out there who are very protective of their privacy, and will say, is this ethical, using people's DNA for these purposes? Is it invasive? What is your feeling on this?
Well, my feeling is this, is once you get to the point where your DNA is in the databases we use, there's like 4 or 5 decisions you've gone through. First, to take a direct-to-consumer test, for recreational reasons. Two, no matter if you've tested with Ancestry, MyHeritage, 23andMe, you have the right to download that data. So you've made that decision. Then you have made the decision to upload it to the databases we use as a means of helping us out. If it's unidentified human remains cases, generally, you know, that's a humanitarian effort, so we don't have any more restrictions on that. But if it's a violent offender, once you upload, you have to click in that you're okay for us to use that for a violent offender case. So already you've made 4 decisions to allow us to have access, and we don't access your DNA. I want to emphasize that. We don't access the raw data. We only access your list of matches. So if, say, Karen, I'm Jane Doe and you're on my list, I can look to see maybe you and your mother are on my list, so I know that the connection's on your mother's side. And that opens the door to genealogy. It's because, as I said, the list you get is a list of people who share DNA with your unknown person. The more DNA, the closer the relationship, the less DNA, the more distant. And so you take, say you have 10 people that you think are in range that you can build family trees. You take those 10 and you start building the trees. And because they're all related to each other in some fashion, the trees are going to start to connect. So you have this big network, and ideally you'll actually have two networks. One is for the mother of your unknown. One is for the father of the unknown. And you find one person in one network who has married a person in the other network, and those are the parents of who you're looking for. And they may have 9 children. You have to figure which one. But
and then from there, you know, you're talking about identifying these people, but then you have some good old-fashioned telephone calls, right? And looking up things in libraries, and I would imagine birth records and that type of thing.
Well, to build the trees, you do that. You know, you look to see if maybe a genealogist already has their tree online. That's good. You call a courthouse. You look at obituaries online. You look at Facebook. You look at Etsy. You look at eBay. You know, people post on Pinterest, and usually you have an email address to go by to help you identify. So you can 95% of the time you can figure out who that person is that matches your unknown, the cousin of your unknown, and you build their tree out. And you wind up doing this for maybe 10, maybe 20, and you watch those trees connect, as I said, into a big network, and your guy has to fit in that network consistently with everything, like the big Sudoku puzzle.
And one of the things that I found interesting about you, Dr. Fitzpatrick, is that you speak a lot of languages because, by necessity, you obviously have a knack for it, lack of a better word, but you have to call different places in different countries because these people could have roots all over. How many languages do you speak?
Well, that's a tricky question to answer. I understand quite a few. I spoke French since I'm 4. I took Spanish in high school, which stuck. I lived in Switzerland for a while. So let's say English, German, French, and Spanish. I'd say maybe a little rusty right now because I speak English every day. But I've studied Chinese. I've studied Russian. And I can understand, like, Dutch because it's so close to German. I can't understand every word. But the real thrill is when I go somewhere and I don't know the language and I have to pick up words. And you'd be amazed at international sign language, what you can get away with. A cab driver tries to cheat you. You know, in Taiwan, the cab fare had gone down $5 and they were charging me the full amount, like $35. International sign language, 3-0, 3-0. You know, and you point to the red. So, you know, you can really get away with a lot and you absolutely not understand the language at all. It's great. It's fun.
I just think that's a really interesting thing. And we've got just like 2 minutes left, but I want to quickly ask you these questions. How many unidentified bodies are found every year in the U.S.? And I assume that you do a lot of work with these unidentified Jane Does.
We do. And it's very hard to estimate. Years ago, in about 2007, there was a census of medical examiners and coroner offices. It wasn't complete, you know. And they said 4,400 a year. I think that's low, and that was in 2007. So I think there's 1,000 residual every year that are never accounted for. So I think the most recent is 44,000, but I'm telling you it's probably a lot higher. That's the only number we really have to go on, but it's a lot higher.
Is there some idea? I mean, it sounds simplistic to someone with a simple head like me. I'm saying if there are all those bodies and you just do DNA testing of them, right, and then you look at people who have disappeared and are looking for loved ones who dropped off the face of the earth, wouldn't that be a rather simple way of kind of trying to figure out who these people are?
It should be, but a lot of people are not reported missing. And some of the cases we have are back in the 80s when they'd say, oh, just wait another day. She'll come home. You know, and they were never reported missing. So we go back and they say, yeah, we don't know where our uncle or our daughter went. And we had no, and we went to go report it and they wouldn't listen to us. They said she went away with her boyfriend. We get a lot of that. But as time goes on, we're trying to be more comprehensive about collecting that. It's just not a one-to-one. Somebody, we don't, and I want to say in what we do, we don't solve the missing person's case. We solve mostly a missing person's case, right? Because if you say your loved one's missing, you'd need a private investigator and maybe some luck. But so we don't necessarily solve the case. We solve a case with every unidentified remain set we come across.
When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about your work with Holocaust survivors. And there are three cases that we've identified that are really interesting and will be interesting for our listeners. And one involves a murder from 1972 of a woman named a little girl, 15-year-old girl named Julie Hansen. And she disappeared in Naperville at a time where Naperville was a cornfield and not just the bustling suburb it is. But we're going to be talking about that case and how that was resolved. We're here talking to Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick. She is really the inventor of forensic genetic genealogy, and she has a business called Identifinders. And how can people contact you?
Our website is www.identifinders.com. You can email info@identifinders.com. You can email me at Colleen, C-O-L-L-E-E-N, at identifinders.com.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking more about this fascinating topic. Happy Mother's Day to everyone out there. You're listening to WGN.
Keep WGN just a click away. Hey, it's Lisa Dent. Set the first button on your digital dashboard for Chicago's very own. Find out how at WGNradio.com.
It is 70 degrees under bright sunny skies at 4:30. Good afternoon. I'm Ron Brown. The news is sponsored by ChicagoENT.com. Zelensky is set to meet with Putin tomorrow. We will have the latest. First, a quick look at sports. The White Sox are Mother's Day winners. They beat the Miami Marlins at Wright Field 4-2 today to send a lot of mothers home happy. Cubs lost to the Mets at Citi Field. The game was tied at 2-2 in the eighth inning, and the Mets broke it open with four runs. Final score, Mets win 6-2. Pete Crow Armstrong did homer for the Cubs against his former team. WGN traffic. We have solid traffic on the Kennedy outbound between Division and Costner, a 49-minute delay. The Eisenhower is reporting a 21-minute delay outbound between California Avenue and 25th Avenue. And a 15-minute delay on DuSable Lakeshore Drive, where it is stop-and-go traffic northbound between 18th and Chicago Avenue. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says he's hoping for a full and temporary ceasefire with Russia starting tomorrow. He says he'll be in Turkey to negotiate with Russian President Vladimir Putin personally. Ukraine, along with European allies, had demanded that Russia accept an unconditional 30-day ceasefire starting on Monday before holding talks. It was not clear if Zelensky was conditioning his presence in Turkey on the Monday ceasefire holding. U.S. negotiators say substantial progress was made after 2 days of negotiations with a Chinese delegation on ways to ease a trade war. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said there was a great deal of productivity. Pope Leo XIV has called for a just and lasting peace in Ukraine and an immediate ceasefire in Gaza with the release of hostages and delivery of humanitarian aid. In his first Sunday noon blessing as Pontiff, Leo said never again war from St. Peter's Basilica to an estimated 100,000 people below. The forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Tonight, mostly clear and a low of 52. Tomorrow, partly sunny and a chance of some late evening showers. A high near 80 degrees. Right now, it's 70 degrees at O'Hare, 71 degrees at Midway, and it is 64 degrees in Waukegan. I'm Ron Brown, WGN News. Next news when it happens. Next scheduled news at 5 o'clock with Steve Ruxton.
Hi, I'm Ken Mariotti with Woodland Windows and Doors. Elevate your home this summer with Marvin Altrex fiberglass windows from Woodland Windows and Doors, a trusted installer since 1969. Our expert installers ensure top-notch service. Plus, for a limited time, enjoy 10% off installation. Don't miss out. Upgrade your windows with Marvin for lasting beauty and energy efficiency. Visit woodlandwindows.com. That's woodlandwindows.com.
You understand the premise.
Yes, the premise is a promise.
And the promise is for our big bank.
To be like First American Bank.
No, no, no. We promise to try and be like First American Bank.
What?
It's impossible for us to be like First American Bank. They have the best loan deals in town.
Really?
Really. And First American Bank gives you a First American Bank loan specialist.
Yeah?
Who works with you every step of the way.
No.
Yes.
So no shuffling them around from department to department, person to person?
Just a First American Bank specialist to make the loan process quicker. quick, easy, and smooth.
Huh. So First American Bank can do everything a big bank like us can do and more.
Yeah, makes me nauseous, too.
Ooh, better idea. We just promised to be more like First American Bank. I mean, is more or is less than more still more?
Oh.
We'll fool everyone.
Yeah, love it.
Thank you.
First American Bank, the bank that does more for your money. Visit firstambank.com or call us at 847-952-3700. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
I can't believe how spotless my floors look after using the Swiffer Power Mop. No more dragging around a heavy mop and messy bucket. Now I get the same deep clean without all the work. Thanks to the powerful solution and scrubbing pad of the Swiffer Power Mop, dirt and grime don't stand a chance, and I don't break a sweat. Mic drop. I mean, mop drop.
Swiffer Power Mop. Swiffer Power Mop.
A smarter way to mop. Try it or your money back.
Meet Alan, who was diagnosed with sleep apnea.
I was what they call a mouth breather, and I would breathe at night with my mouth open.
And for about 8 years, Alan struggled with a CPAP machine. And then?
And then I saw the Advent commercial, and I thought, well, what do you got to lose? This machine is miserable.
For most people, CPAP machines are miserable, but a simple breathing triangle solution from Advent can be life-changing.
And it really was, to me it was amazing, because I don't think I ever breathed that clear.
This is Dr. Madan Kandula. After having one of Advent's simple breathing triangle procedures, people are amazed at how freely and clearly they can breathe.
I'm happy with the procedure. I'm very glad I did it. I wish I would have done it 20 years ago. I could have avoided that machine I had to have laying next to the bed with the hose wrapped around my head.
Schedule your appointment at AdventKnows.com, because Advent knows when you breathe well, you live better. Results may vary. Most insurance accepted.
Lou Lamperdini here. Lindeman Chimney Heating and Cooling can update your old wood-burning fireplaces to a modern, hassle-free gas fireplace. Book today at Lindeman.com.
Hey, Scooter, you're caller 21. You win the golf foursome.
I won? Bob, I've never won anything on the radio my whole life. Bob, you know what time I'm going to tee off at?
No.
Four? Next time you go golfing, Bob, you got to take two pairs of pants.
Why is that, Scooter?
In case you get a hole-in-one.
Bob Surratt.
I love the show, Bob.
Weekday mornings at 6 on WGN.
Hello, and welcome back. We're here with Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick. She is a genetic genealogist. In fact, she really did invent and pioneered this whole science. Let's talk about some fascinating cases that you have worked on. You have done work with Holocaust survivors. There's an example that you talked to me about regarding Canada and Australia. Can you tell us the story from the beginning?
Well, the story is about Alex Kurtzum. He was picked up as an orphan in 1942 in the forest around Minsk. He was picked up by a Latvian police battalion who were civil peacekeepers, keeping the bridges open, keeping the partisans from, you know, blowing up the trains. And they took him in. They made him a mascot. They gave him a little uniform. And, you know, that became his family. When the war got really bad, they took him to a chocolate factory in Riga, and the director took him in as a foster child, and he wound up staying with that family the rest of his life. After they left after the war, and they wound up in Australia, and he went with them. So that was his, you know, family in the end. So as he got older, in about the 80s and 90s, he started talking about his real biological family, and he revealed for the first time that he was Jewish, and shortly before they picked him up in the forest, that he had watched his whole family be slaughtered by a Nazi unit, not the Latvians, but a Nazi unit. So there was a lot of doubts about that, but it sort of took a life of its own, and there was he thought he found his brother in Minsk, a brother who worked for the Holocaust Center in Minsk. So based on that, there was a documentary made about that reunion, and there was a best-selling book that was sold like in 20 countries in 17 languages, something like that, called The Mascot. But as the book got more well known, there was a lot of suspicions that it wasn't true because he didn't act like he was Jewish. You know, he actually wasn't raised that way, but he didn't act like he was Jewish. So there was a lot of maybe inconsistencies in the story. So anyway, he appeared in February 2009 on 60 Minutes, and somebody called me and said, "I saw this. I don't believe this guy. Could you please look into whether the story's true or not?" And I had already been part of exposing two Holocaust frauds. That took a few months. So I said, "Oh, sure, no problem." And of course, 15 years later, I'm still at it. And it's really an interesting story. But in the end, he finally took a DNA test. We discovered first cousins in Canada. And one of those cousins had been born in the same village that he claimed to have been born in. And another cousin had pictures of his parents, his older brother and his older sister, who were killed in the Holocaust. Now, you know, there's more mysteries. You know, we don't know his first name, and we don't know some of the other names in the family. But, you know, I'd say it's unusual that somebody who was from Belarus who lived in Australia was united with his cousins in Canada by somebody living in California. You just can't make this stuff up.
Amazing. And it all proved out to be true. Let's talk about the case of Julie Hansen, a little 15-year-old girl who was brutally murdered in 1972 in the Naperville area. Can you tell our listeners about this case?
I sure can. And I think it's a good case to talk about here in Illinois because she lived in Naperville, Illinois. And in, I think, July 1972, she borrowed a bicycle to go to a summer baseball game that evening. She never came home. Her parents were out of town. She had a younger brother and older sister who was 18. And when she didn't come home, the sister reported her missing the next morning, went out to look for her, and they found her in a cornfield about 10 minutes away. She had been stabbed over 36 times and raped post-mortem. Clothes had been put on again. It's pretty gruesome. So, of course, in 72, you couldn't really do much but canvass the neighborhood, see if anybody saw something unusual, question a few of the, you know, kind of weird neighbors, hope he dropped his driver's license in the field. No, nothing. So put everything in the newspaper, you know, hoping some leads would come. But no, not in 1972, there wasn't a whole lot you could do. So fast forward. I had spoken to the Naperville Police Department in 2018 at a conference in Las Vegas. And they basically said, "Hey, we have this case. We're just starting to figure out this whole genealogy, you know." Okay, so I told them what I knew at the time. It was really kind of early in this whole forensic genetic genealogy story. And so then 2019, I checked in, and they said, "No, we're still figuring it out." So 2020, they came back to me because they said, we have asked another company that's known for this, and, you know, they said that they didn't think it was solvable. It was, the DNA was too degraded, you know, and they were sort of, the technology they were using called microarray would not work well with really bad DNA they were faced with after 50 years. So the people, the police department, the DNA lab wouldn't give up. And somebody remembered they had spoken to me. So they said, "Why don't you talk to Colleen and, you know, maybe." And I said, "Well, actually, there's other technology which might make it work called whole genome. I can't tell you it will work. I'll tell you it's a high-risk case, but you have a chance." So there was two samples left. One had about a third of what we need. We usually need a nanogram, and we had that was a 1/1,000,000th of a gram. It's about 300 cells. So we wound up using almost no DNA, very degraded. The degradation was infinite. So we threw it in the air. We threw the spaghetti on the wall to see if it would stick. And about 6 months later, we got the DNA, the data. We uploaded it to the database, and we solved it in about 2 hours.
And it was a guy in the neighborhood.
It was. He lived a mile away, named Barry Welpley. Nobody had ever asked him. He was under the radar. He had moved to Minnesota and under the radar, got his DNA, proved it matched the crime scene. He was extradited to Illinois in a $10 million bond. And unfortunately, he died about a year ago, still waiting trial because he was fighting tooth and nail to stay out of that. And then, so the family was disappointed but relieved. You know, it's a two-sided story there. And That's it.
Fascinating. And, you know, I always have my questions about whether he continued on in that life of crime. And I guess we'll never know that either, just because, you know, people who do this kind of thing generally don't stop. It's usually not one and done.
Yeah, well, he might pop up. There may be another murder somewhere where we collect. You never know. But as far as we know, as far as the investigators could find out, he didn't have anything else so far.
We're talking to Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick. Her business is Identifinders, and we're going to be talking to her all the way up into the 5 o'clock hour. And if you have any questions for her, give us a call here at 312-981-7200, or you can text to that same number, 312-981-7200. Back in a minute.
Chicago's very own WGN.
There's an amazing supper club in Wisconsin Dells, Ishnala, nestled among the pines and perched above the sandstone bluffs of Mirror Lake. The beauty, the history, the service, the food, the fun. Hi, this is Bob Prosser, owner of Ishnala Supper Club in Wisconsin Dells. I've been a part of Ishnala since 1973, and I am so proud to continue the tradition that began in 1953. Why not enjoy a brandy old-fashioned in one of our bars, each with a spectacular view overlooking Mirror Lake, or just relax before or after dinner on one of our outdoor decks? Our Ishnala chefs have prepared your favorites, 24-ounce ribeye, cold water lobster tails, North Atlantic salmon, and of course, Ishnala's roast duck. Thank you for making Ishnala Wisconsin's favorite supper club, where the only thing we overlook is Mirror Lake. I'm Bob Prosser, and I want to serve you.
Frondelmax Vexillando.
Ben.
Nargalento Zipidorium.
Ben.
Yes, Nicole?
Do I have to ask?
Why am I wearing a wizard's cape?
Yes.
Because of the Brooklyn Cabinet.
The Brooklyn Cabinet?
Have you heard of it?
Of course. It's the most configurable piece in Penny Mustard's history.
Configurabulous Maximus.
But what's with the wizard getup?
The Brooklyn Cabinet looks like something you'd see in the hallowed halls of a faraway magical campus.
That curved top is pretty enchanting.
And with all the configurable options, you get to work your personal magic.
Cabinenta implortum.
Wait, what are you waving?
My magic wand, Arvid.
That's a beef stick.
Hey, even wizards get hungry.
Right.
Snackiest summonoso.
Come see the bewitching Brooklyn Cabinet. American made with locally sourced lumber and built to last for generations. Starting at $43.78 at Penny Mustard.
7 locations throughout Chicagoland.
PennyMustard.com.
Penny Mustard Furnishing.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bal Nandra from Ivy Solution and Ketamine Centers of Chicago. My clinic uses ketamine to conquer major depression, anxiety, and PTSD. Ketamine for depression has been described as the greatest advancement in mental health in over 50 years, with an up to 80% success rate and often immediate relief. Here's my patient, Antonio, who suffered for years from major depression and anxiety, describing how ketamine from Ivy Solution changed his life.
Prior to my going to see Dr. Nandra, I was unhappy, depressed, was a little bit lost. There was a lot of gray. It's like being in a swimming pool and not knowing which side to get out of. And then, you know, I spoke to Dr. Nandra and decided to go and start ketamine treatment. And things changed, like shockingly fast. I feel like I got lucky because somebody said, here's a shortcut.
It's time you conquer your depression and anxiety. Call for your free consultation in Chicago or Kansas City. 844-9-IVY-MEDS. That's 844-948-6337. Or visit KetamineChicago.com. KetamineChicago.com.
Welcome back and happy Mother's Day to everyone out there. Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick is here in studio. She is the pioneer, the inventor of genetic genealogy. And what we're going to do is we're going to try to run through some of the interesting cases that she's worked on over the years and give you a few fun details. The Titanic baby. Dr. Fitzpatrick, tell us about the Titanic baby.
Well, I want to say in that case, I worked with the Armed Forces DNA Lab and I really did a lot of the genealogy. I didn't really do a lot of the DNA part because that was really before the forensic genetic genealogy came in. When the Titanic sank, there was like 300 something bodies that were recovered from where the accident happened. One of those was a child. He was buried in Halifax in 1912. Big ceremony, beautiful beautiful funeral. And then in the late 90s, there was a family from Sweden came and said, we think that's our relative. So they got in the legal documents to exhume the body. And then they did DNA, and they were able to rule out four children. There were six that qualified, because in 1912, they had an index card saying, this is a boy. He's about 2 years old. This is his clothes, probably a third-class passenger. All right. Knowing he's about two, narrowed it about six kids. First round of DNA testing eliminated four. Two left. And because there was, instead of doing more DNA, they brought in tooth experts, pediatric odontologists, whatever. And they said, well, it's probably, the one was 19 months old, English baby, one was a 14 month old. And they said that the child was probably the younger child. So big ceremony. It was identified as Eno Panula from Finland. And then somebody said, well, wait a minute, that's not right, because the shoes of this child were preserved in the museum. When they went to go burn the clothes to keep souvenir hunters away, the guy guarding the rink, ice rink, put the shoes in his desk and kept them and wound up in the museum years later. Somebody said, wait a minute, those shoes would have fallen off a 14-month-old baby. So, okay, but the DNA, it turned out, between those two was tied. It was exactly the same. So this is mitochondrial DNA. It was the same. So they made the decision based on the tooth experts. And then the shoes came up, the issue with the shoes. So they did another round of DNA testing. They were still tied. So then I helped try and find, that was the maternal line, tried to find more genealogy, didn't work out. So finally, after like the fourth round of testing, they were looking for, these two children had the same maternal ancestor in the same 2000, in the last 2000 years. So that's why they were related. They were actually cousins. So finally the lab AFDIL went through and found a special marker that had been used to break these kind of ties. And it turned out, it was wrong. It was the 19-month-old English baby, Sidney Leslie Goodwin. That was done on basis of maybe one cell of the child's body. Once that was consumed, that was it. If that hadn't worked, we'd never would have known.
Fascinating. Charles Lindbergh, just quickly, can you just tell our listeners a little bit about the kidnapping of Charles Lindbergh's son?
Well, in 1932, well-known, you know, Charles Lindbergh's son was kidnapped. He was found deceased a couple of weeks later in the area. So, and yet there's always been some lingering doubts that Bruno Richard Hauptmann, who was executed for it, it was some lingering doubts about whether he was guilty or whether he was involved, who maybe Lindbergh himself. So one of the items that now exist in the New Jersey State Police Museum is the letters, the ransom letters. The letters themselves have a lot of forensic value, you know, a lot of historical value, but the envelopes have never really been, you know, something to talk about. However, now they are, because now we can get DNA from the saliva underneath those flaps.
Even after all those years?
There's been a study on letters. You can get DNA from letters back to 1865 because the DNA's trapped. And there's not really that much bacteria. It's been, now if you put the letter in the sun for a week, you know, of course, but most of these letters have been, you know, cared for and kept probably, you know, out of the heat and light. Anyway, so we have hope that if we can get access to those letters, we can get the DNA and see who licked the envelopes, and therefore it would give us more information on, you know, more information about what exactly happened.
So if Hauptmann didn't do it, then it has to be somebody else.
Yeah, it could be Lindbergh. It could have been a go-between. There's an argument that you don't want to disturb any historical items, but I would say the envelopes themselves have almost no historical value itself. But I would say if somebody came and saw a little piece of envelope was missing, that would raise the historical value. Somebody's going to say, what happened to that envelope? And you'd say, oh, that's the piece that was used to get DNA to prove that.
Right.
That was a crime of the century. Now it's a paragraph in textbooks.
Absolutely. And that I've read about that story for years and all the different theories about who might have done it. What about Amelia Earhart? Have you had any dealings with that? And again, can you remind our listeners who may not remember who she was?
I don't remember the year, maybe 1934. She was a very famous aviator, a woman aviator, and she planned to fly around the world. And she got lost over the Pacific Ocean. There was maybe some radio contact, and she disappeared. There was a massive attempt to find her, and it's an open mystery now. So there was a group that went to the island where they thought Gardner Island, which is now called Nikumamuro, and they had, you know, had excavated, they had collected artifacts. It was sort of like a Polynesian island with not many people, and the British held it during the war. So it wasn't really populated too much. And so they were hoping, these expedition was hoping to find some remains that they could test for DNA. And in the meantime, I didn't do Amelia's genealogy because she's well known. I did her navigator Fred Noonan's genealogy and found a family reference that could be used in case they got the DNA, in case they found something. Nothing has been found so far, but that that genealogy goes from her her navigator. You know, his mother died when he was four, so that starts the problems there. Had to go back to the 1600s and forward just to get that right relative that could give that right kind of DNA in case they find the remains. That DNA, the solution of to the, if they find DNA at the crash site and it doesn't belong to Amelia, the solution to the Amelia Earhart mystery may be in my refrigerator in Huntington Beach, California.
Absolutely. So my question is this, with more people doing these DNA testings and all of this, does that increase of the database make your job easier in some ways?
It absolutely does. You never know. Along the way, sometimes, like I say, you have DNA cousins. Some are real close, some are real distant. And so, you know, if you suddenly, like that sister that took the test, she was looking for her lost sister. You know, Patricia Newsom was the lost sister, East Haven Jane Doe. And the fact the sister had presence of mind to take that DNA test helped us solve it in 5 minutes after working on the DNA for 3 years.
We have like just 4 minutes, but I want to touch on a story that I never even heard of, and it's referred to in Wikipedia as the, is it the Sonnerton?
Somerton Man.
The Somerton Man.
Yeah.
It's in 1948, a man is found on a beach in Adelaide, Australia. He's got some strange poem, not a strange poem, but a poem in his pocket, and he's got a note that says something in Persian like, it's finished.
Yeah.
And you helped find who this guy was, and for all those years, no one knew who he was. Could you really tell us who?
I can. He had no tickets in his clothes, the label's gone, you know, nothing. And so when before they buried him, they never figured it out, you know, never knew why he died. They had made a plaster cast of his upper body. And fortunately, when they did that, they trapped hair, bundles of hair, and they were remained in the cast. So there was a professor in Adelaide who had done extensive research on him, and he got a forensic anthropologist to pull the middle of, hair out the middle of those bundles so that it wasn't exposed to the plaster. And we used that to develop genealogy data. And again, we got his DNA cousins. It was a little tricky because this was from Australia. It wasn't from the U.S. We didn't have many matches, but we did it. We had one that worked out. And in the end, we found out his name was Carl Webb. He was separated from his wife. He died, and we traced the wife. She was going to have to divorce him for desertion. Okay?
Didn't.
And it turned out that, you know, she was a pharmacist. You know, and when she gave the divorce decree, she talked about all this horrible stuff that happened between them, the fights and the domestic, and how he was depressed. And one day she came in and he had taken 50 phenobarbital tablets, and he was like out, you know, and soaking wet in bed, and she's trying to revive him. But you got to keep in mind, she was a pharmacist, you know, so you have to think, they're going through a divorce, and you think about that. So phenobarbital only stays in your system for an hour. It doesn't stay in your system for 70 years, so we'll probably never know.
That's an interesting one. There's a movie there somewhere. Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick, thank you so much for joining us here. You're in town in Chicago, and if people, your company, Identifinders International, what kind of people could use your services?
Well, mostly law enforcement, medical examiners, DAs, people, Innocence Project, you know, we work with the legal profession and the law enforcement profession to help them solve cold cases, maybe even some hot cases. So, you know.
And one of the problems, and we talked about this, is that sometimes the police departments don't want to give up their cold case materials to people like you. And to me, like we have a case here, the Percy murder, which happened. Charles Percy was a senator, and his beautiful daughter was killed in her Kenilworth mansion. And the police, it's been a cold case for all these years and the police are holding on to all their evidence. And sometimes it takes a lawsuit. Sometimes even a lawsuit doesn't work out. But
sometimes it takes success stories because
exactly.
As this becomes more well known and you see more and more success stories, more and more law enforcement agencies are actually becoming genealogists. You know, they see it and it's gaining momentum. So after a while, this will be just one of the tools in the box.
Absolutely. And anyway, thank you so much for joining us. How can people get a hold of you?
www.identifinders.com. Colleen at identifinders.com or info at identifinders.com. Love to hear from you.
So I just want to say that if you would like to reach me at my office, I know people have legal questions. I didn't take any legal questions today, but I know you have them, so you can always email me. That's probably the best way to reach me, and that's WGN@AskKarenConti.com, WGN@AskKarenConti.com, or you can call me at 312-332-7800. I can answer your question if I can. If I can't, I usually can find you someone who can. I have a group of referrals for people who do estate planning and criminal defense work and all kinds of work. And if I can't answer your question, I will certainly do my best to try to find someone who can. Thank you, Patrick, for being a great producer. Stay tuned for the great Rick Hogan, who is coming up next. And happy Mother's Day to everyone out there. You're listening to WGN.